Georgia's DBHDD reminds people that the Good Samaritan Law can save lives during alcohol and drug overdoses. People are urged to call 911 and stay until help arrives. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Political Rewind. I'm Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, sitting in for Bill Nygut. We're wrapping up the first week of jury selection in the trial over the slaying of Ahmaud Arbery down in Brunswick. Attorneys have spent the last 4 days questioning scores of potential jurors about their views on the case, guns, and racial justice in America. They're only a third of the way done, and there are major questions about how long it will take to find enough people who haven't already made up their minds. Not to mention many questions about what the verdict will mean as the country continues to grapple with race, racism, and the role they play in its institutions. Here to unpack all of this with me is a really excellent panel, starting with my colleague Asia Simone Burns. She's a crime reporter at the AJC who's been on the ground in Brunswick covering the trial this week, and it's also her first appearance on Political Rewind. Welcome, Asia.
Hi, Tamar. Thank you so much for having me.
Next, we have Fred Smith, a constitutional law professor at Emory University. It's good to have you back again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And last but not least, we have Major Woodall. He's a public policy associate for the Southern Center for Human Rights, and he's the former state president of the Georgia NAACP. He's also working on a book about racism in the mind. How's it going, Major?
All is well. Good to see you. Good to be back with you all today.
Awesome. I'm so excited to dive right in with this panel. And I'd like to start with Asia, who's spent the last week in Brunswick. Talk to us about what the scene has been like at the courthouse and in this nearby park where I guess the attorneys have been sifting through some 600 potential jurors.
Yes, yes. Well, since we've been here, both what has been happening inside and outside of the courthouse has been absolutely fascinating. Inside, you have the prosecutor and the defense attorneys trying to seat a panel of impartial jurors. And there were 1,000 jury summonses that were sent out. About 600 people have actually arrived for jury duty. And for the past week, they've been arriving for individual questioning and for group questioning. And some of the statements that they've made have been what I would say are surprising and rather telling. And we can get into a little bit of that. But equally fascinating is outside of the courthouse, there have been, as you would expect, demonstrators gathered for days, being very vocal about not only wanting justice for Ahmaud, but wanting to draw attention to the racial dynamics that existed in Brunswick prior to Ahmaud's death or prior to Mr. Arbery's death.
Yeah, and how unusual is this scene? Because a lot of this stuff, especially as they're vetting these potential jurors, isn't a lot of this happening outside, or are they being kind of brought in group by group? That's pretty unusual.
The jurors are being brought in group by group. They're reporting to the courthouse in groups of about 20 for questioning from the prosecutor and from the defense attorneys. Meanwhile, the demonstrators are stationed in a courtyard that is a few yards away from the courthouse, but still immediately in front of it. So as you have the jurors coming in and out of the courthouse and parking in a parking lot on the side of the building, there is this group that is not meeting them, but is relatively nearby as they're reporting for a jury. So it's something that actually happened inside of the courthouse yesterday, an attorney defending Roddy Bryan, attorney Kevin Goff, expressed some concerns about the group being there in the first place, saying that the banners and the Justice for Ahmaud T-shirts, some of the signs that they were carrying, could potentially influence the jurors as they're coming in and out of the courthouse and essentially make it harder to seat an impartial jury for this case. Since it's happening in a public square, the court has made it pretty evident that they don't have any purview over the demonstration that's happening, since it is not something that's happening inside of the courthouse. But that is something that came up and was expressed by the defense attorneys that is a concern of theirs.
Major, I want to bring you into the conversation here. Finding impartial jurors, will be such a struggle, and it has been for the last couple of days, given just how far and wide this cell phone video of Travis and Greg McMichael, pursuing Ahmaud Arbery and then shooting him at close range. It's gone everywhere, and it's almost impossible to find people who aren't familiar with the case or don't have strong opinions about this. So weigh in on that.
Well, I think that goes to the failures of our legal process, that a video that has, for all intent and purposes, been a part of this evidence from the date, from the very onset of this case, or from the very onset of the incident itself, that anybody who has seen it would remain impartial, because it's telling. We had a district attorney, Jackie Johnson, who blocked the arrest of these individuals, Travis and Gregory McMichael. And she believed that, arrest wasn't warranted, that criminal accountability was not necessary. Then you go to George Barnhill, who is currently the district attorney in the Waycross Circuit, who pens a two, three-page letter that goes into detail, great detail, as to why 17-4-60, well, what was 17-4-60, which was Georgia's statute on citizen's arrest, justifies the unauthorized use of deadly force in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. And I use the language murder very intentionally. And so when we see the legal standards that are being paraded around by system actors, official officers of the court, and they do not have any congruence with any real jurisprudence, any real expectations of accountability and quote unquote law and order. And then when you get to this point in the trial or in the trial process where jurors are being selected and folks are asked whether or not they've actually seen the video or if they have any ill feelings about either the defendant or any of the defendants, and if this matter has moved them one way or another, that is quite telling as to what kind of system, the legal system we have in this country.
Fred, what, if anything, can the judge and the attorneys do in a situation like this to kind of ensure a fair and a speedy trial?
Yeah, so what's happening right now is a process I call voir dire. In different parts of the country, that's pronounced differently. And outside of the country, it's pronounced entirely differently. But during that process, they're asking questions of large swaths of people. Some of them are very routine questions. Do you know anyone related specifically to this case? And then some of them are questions that are kind of more specific to and tailored to these set of facts, including questions around people's views, not only about race, but also their views about guns, questions about whether or not they own guns, views about gun control, et cetera. And then there's kind of the more individual questioning that Asia was just talking about, right, in terms of their specific views about this case and whether or not they prejudged it. And perhaps that is, outside of the questions like, are you related to someone in this case, those are some of the most important questions. Because some of these questions are designed to figure out whether or not someone can be removed for cause, right? So if someone tells the court, I can't be fair here, they're guilty, and no matter what I see, I conclude they're guilty. That's a basis for what they call a for cause challenge, where someone can make a motion and the judge can remove the person. Some of these other questions, like do you own a gun, et cetera, those are designed for peremptory challenges, where within the discretion of either the prosecution or within the discretion of the defense, they can categorically remove someone, as long as they're not removing them for race or sex or religion, and in some jurisdictions, not Georgia, sexual orientation. As long as they're not removing them for one of those reasons, then they have entire discretion. The prosecution here has 12 of those, as I recall, and the defense in total has 24 of those. And so So that's why you're hearing the types of questions that you're asking. Some of them are for cause, and some of them are for peremptory challenges. And the idea in the end is to achieve an impartial jury of one's peers. But as is being alluded to, and I think we're about to discuss more, that's a particular challenge in this case.
Asia, let's talk a little bit about this process where the prosecution and the defense can kind of strike down people and, you know, the not fighting, but a little bit of scuffling in terms of the types of questions that are being asked of potential jurors. How much fighting has there been at this point? And are there concerns, at least, that the prosecution has raised that the defense is trying to cut people because of their race, which is illegal?
At this point, we haven't seen that fighting that the defense or the prosecution are trying to cut people from their race. But some of the questions that have been asked have been a little bit heated, have been met with a lot of different types of responses. I'll bring it back to the very first day of questioning. The prospective jurors were asked if they had any negative impressions about any of the three defendants. And several of them answered in the affirmative. Some of them said that they had negative impressions of all three defendants. Some said that they've seen the case on social media, that essentially that the information that they have about the case has been surrounding them on social media and in the news to the point where they're sick of it. One juror number two, even said that he said that he felt that all three were guilty and has shared a cell phone video of the shooting and has talked about the case with his brother. So we're really seeing that this is a case that a lot of the people that are being brought in are familiar with. And so some of these people are being struck for cause. Some of these people have been qualified. And going forward, it'll be really interesting to see who actually makes it onto this panel.
Major, Brunswick is a pretty small city. It's only about 85,000 people. It's about 70% white, about 27% black. And I know that the decision has been made to intentionally keep the case in Brunswick just because people know the McMichaels outside of all of this. But I'm wondering what you think should be done. Should this case be tried in Glynn County? There's been talk about whether it's even possible to do that, given just how much this cell phone video has gone around, given how much this, you know, Arbery's death has resonated with the community.
Well, one, I'll clarify that Brunswick is a predominantly African-American community. Glynn County is the exact opposite. And so when you think about where this murder took place, it was in Satilla Shores, which is an unincorporated part of Glynn County. And so when we think through the duty to have an impartial jury of their peers, they're talking about Glynn Countyans, right? And so I think no matter where you go, there's going to be someone who has foreknowledge of what took place. But I'm not a lawyer, but from what I understand, it's not necessarily you know about a thing, but rather do you have the ability to be impartial? And so if you can receive, you know, the evidence that's presented by the state and the defense, and you can make a very impartial determination as to whether or not there has been an admission or an execution of guilt in a matter, then you should be able to be impaneled. And ultimately, that's what we're calling for. We're calling for due process. We're calling for the legal system to do what it claims it always does. And we've seen up until this point that has not happened. And we're not going to rest until that process is executed in the manner to which they always claim it's done. And we're using taxpayer dollars for this. And so we need to ensure that the legal system is performing to the standards that we expect them to.
Fred, is the best case scenario here for the defense maybe not that the jury can be impartial, but that they can be open-minded, given what we've seen so far? And is it possible or at this point to really move the case out of Glynn County at this point if that needs to happen?
All right, so I'm going to actually start with the second question because it'll help me work my way back to the first, if I can remember. So the second question in terms of change of venue, So in Georgia, there is a change of venue statute in criminal cases, but it's the defendant who is able to make that motion. And they're able to make that motion whenever facts arise that lead that form the basis for their evidence that it's impossible for a jury to be impartial. So it's not necessarily too late, because sometimes it's the actual voir dire process that provides the evidence that a jury cannot be impartial. The prosecution cannot move the case, and part of that is because every criminal defendant has a right to a jury of his or her peers. And so the defendant can waive that right and say, hey, I think I can only get a fair trial by someone who's not my peer somewhere else. But the prosecution can't waive that right on the defendant's behalf. I would be surprised in this circumstance if the defense did attempt to move the case. And that's for a number of reasons. One is the reason that Major pointed out, which is that Glynn County, which is where the jury pool is being drawn from, is 70% white, but also because of some of the answers to the questions. So, for example, for one of the panels, when the defense attorney asked, have you ever voted against someone because, or sorry, have you ever voted for someone because they were in favor of gun control? No juror raised their hand. Not a single juror raised their hand. If this trial were in Cobb County or at Savannah or where have you, it's hard to imagine that particular result. So from the outset, some of the political views that the defense seems to be getting at are more present in Glynn County than they would be perhaps in some other places. Another reason why I'd be surprised is because Glynn County has been so saturated with information about this particular case that there are lots of people who are willing to say, I know the facts very well in this case, and there's nothing you can show me that will cause me to change my mind. And I'm not sure you would find as many such people even here in Atlanta. Here in Atlanta, yes, we saw the video a year and a half ago. We haven't seen it since. It's not something that has kind of permeated kind of our everyday culture and understanding of our community in a way that it's happened there. And so if you're removing every juror who says, no, I have prejudged this, I am pretty sure they're guilty, then you may end up with an ultimate jury that doesn't actually reflect the community. And it's kind of skewed toward being particularly sympathetic to the defendant. I can analogize it to death penalty cases, where if you remove everyone who says, I'm sorry, I can't condemn someone to death who's not an imminent threat to anyone, I can't do it. Then what the experts have demonstrated is that results in juries that are more inclined to find someone guilty. And I think you might have sort of a version of that emerging right now in Glynn County, where a jury that's more likely to find the defendant not guilty than the overall pool in Glynn County may be emerging.
Asia, we've talked a little bit about the scene outside of the courthouse this week, but as you walk around the city of Brunswick, what's the mood that you're feeling right now? Not only are there locals, but there's also folks who've been bussed in from different parts of the country who feel so strongly about what happened to Ahmaud Arbery that they wanted to be there. So how are those two groups kind of interfacing with each other?
It is a really interesting dynamic between locals and between people that are being bussed in. On the second day of jury selection, following the lunch break, Marcus Arbery, Ahmaud Arbery's father, accompanied a group from the Transformative Justice Coalition to Sutila Shores to visit the scene of this inciting incident. And while they were there, the people that were with the Transformative Justice Coalition, they filled three buses, bussing people in from Philadelphia, from Florida, from all across the nation in order to be here for this first week of judicial proceedings. And there was a very clear dynamic that emerged of people that have been in Brunswick and that are familiar with the Sutila Shores neighborhood, and people that came from out of state for this for this event, for these proceedings. The people that were visiting from out of state seemed almost surprised that Satilla Shores looks like any other neighborhood that maybe they've walked through in their own hometown or wherever they happen to live right now. And the people, the locals that were in the area, they seemed completely unsurprised. They saw this area as a place that has carried so much heartache and so much pain. And it was very obvious the difference that these two groups of people were having as they were looking at this exact same spot.
Yeah. Well, let's take our first break. And when we come back, I want Major to dive in and kind of put this case into context with a lot of the instances of violence that we've seen against young Black men. So this is Political Rewind. Stick with us. We'll be back in a minute. We're back with more Political Rewind. I'm Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter at the AJC, filling in for Bill Nigut. I'm joined today by Emory Law Professor Fred Smith, Major Woodall of the Southern Center for Human Rights, and the AJC's Asia Simone Burns reporting on the ground from Brunswick. Let's jump back into this conversation. Major, this is the first kind of major trial involving the slaying of a young Black man since the Derek Chauvin trial. Obviously, Chauvin was convicted, and I think people saw some measure of justice, but there was also a question about whether America could make a lot of these systematic changes to the way that our institutions deal with race, which I think for the most part haven't happened. And so I'm curious how you're looking at this trial in the context of what happened with Derek Chauvin, and what is the potential here for any kind of semblance of justice?
Well, I'll say what I've said every time I ask this question, and I may be one of the few who will say this, but there's no justice in criminal convictions. There's no justice in legal outcomes that put people behind bars. And the reason I say that is because currently right now, we're seeing the Department of Corrections literally violate the very humanity of people who are incarcerated as we speak. And so that's not justice. What's justice is being able to create a society in which these things do not happen. What's justice is that when these things do happen, we have systems in place and resources and services that can help rehabilitate people to reenter society. But that's not happening. And so while we're here in this moment and we have this criminal trial that's pending and we'll see whether or not there's conviction or an acquittal, that's not justice. It's just not. And I find tension because I want there to be some closure, because that's what a lot of people are looking for this family. They're looking for closure. They're looking for the powers that be to say that this is not okay. Because may we be reminded that before the GBI got involved and arrested the McMichaels and eventually Brian as well, this case was sitting on the shelf. The DA, the second DA, was literally about to let this case go unprosecuted if it was not for the persistence of Ahmaud's mother. That's not justice, and Georgia's legal process should not work in a way in which it requires social and political and public pressure for them to hold people accountable. That shouldn't happen that way.
Fred?
Yeah. I mean, what Major's touching on in some respects is this tension that emerges for a lot of folks who are seeking criminal justice reform, are seeking a world in which we move away from mass incarceration and placing people into conditions where they're facing human rights abuses every day. And there are these moments in which there are questions around, well, will these defendants receive the same, be placed into the same system as everyone else, right? Because that's what equality is, right? So you have this tension between equality and equal dignity and everyone being treated the same way, and the fact that the same way is a world in which there are so many human rights abuses, in which we do incarcerate more people per capita than any democracy on earth. So I just want to point out that really important tension. In terms of whether or not there can be justice, I won't opine on that. I mean, I think it's impossible to say it better than Major just said it. But I will use the phrase that he used a little bit earlier, criminal accountability. Can there be some measure of accountability here? And accountability is important for a number of reasons. One is from a deterrent standpoint, accountability is important. But accountability is also important because it's a moment for the judicial system to declare equal dignity. And that's important to the family here. That's important also to the broader community. And it goes to this this phrase that sometimes calls procedural justice or procedural fairness, that and which has been broken so much already in this case. But when people perceive that a system is unjust or unfair, they become more and more disconnected from their government. They don't just feel like second-class citizens. They feel disconnected, like they're not a part of this democracy at all, right? And that's a major problem for a democratic republic, to have entire swaths of the community who feel more and more disconnected from their government such that they don't feel like it's theirs, right? And so that's why accountability in these moments, among other reasons, that's why it's so important, right? And in this case, where it did take so long, and if the video had not come to light, if there hadn't been so much organizing, then it's not clear that this prosecution would be happening. The district attorney, the original district attorney in this case, is being charged. And it's become, even though I said earlier that it's focused on Glynn County, it has become, in some respects, this interesting and unusual statewide event. The judge in this case is from Chatham County in Savannah. The prosecutor in this case is from Cobb County, and so it's already sort of a really unusual set of facts. What criminal accountability might mean is some measure of procedural justice and procedural fairness.
Major.
Yes, I just want to lift up very briefly the difference, because Fred, he mentioned this, and I don't want the audience to miss sight of what he just said. That Jackie Johnson was indicted for a violation of oath of office, which is a felony, if I recall correctly, that is punishable by no more than, I think it's like a year in prison versus plus and or a fine. What the folks in Brunswick was calling for was an indictment on malfeasance while in office, which are two totally different charges. And when we talk about, and everybody celebrated the legacy that this leads us to if Jackie Johnson is indicted, but she was literally slapped on the wrist. And we've seen a historical legacy of white politicians who do these kinds of things and are not held accountable and are charged with violations of oaths of office and are never actually held accountable at all. And so I just wanted to lift that up because she has not been held accountable. And we saw literally the same week a DA in Columbus who just so happens to be a Democrat be charged with several felonies. And so notwithstanding what he was charged with and what the situations and circumstances surrounding his indictment included, I just want that to be lifted up, that she has not been held accountable, and I'm not going to let her off the hook for that.
I want to bring Asia back into the conversation, but before we do, I did want to ask you, Major, you know, we talk about Jackie Johnson, the Glynn County DA. She did lose her spot in the election last November, which is pretty rare for DAs. Isn't that some teensy-weensy measure of accountability?
Yes and no. So the people of Brunswick, that's what democracy allows, is for us to be able to get rid of prosecutors or elected officials who do not do their jobs of upholding the Constitution against enemies, both foreign and domestic. And it took tooth and nail. But she was defeated, and the people of Brunswick celebrated, and so did we. But the reality is she can still practice law in this state. George Barnhill is still prosecuting cases, or lack thereof, in Waycross Judicial Circuit. And so what we're calling for, I know what the Just Georgia Coalition called for, and when I was president, the NAACP called for, was both of them to be disbarred. Because what they did was they violated the rules of professional conduct, and they cannot be trusted to ever practice law here in this state again, because they simply showed that they were incapable of doing so.
Asia, we've talked a lot about this cell phone video of the McMichaels and that Roddy Bryan shot of them pursuing Ahmaud Arbery. And I want to talk about the role of this video in the trial. The attorneys have been asking prospective jurors how many times they've seen this video. And I think there is an interesting parallel with what happened with Derek Chauvin and George Floyd, because that was also a situation where there was a video that, once it got leaked out, really galvanized the public and got them involved in this case. How much is video kind of going to change the game in this trial? And do you have an understanding yet of how the prosecution is going to be using that video?
Well, the video is already really influencing what will be happening in this trial. The conversation with the prospective jurors has been, have you seen this video? Really trying to get down to the root of what they felt about seeing the video. Some of the responses have been that the people viewing it feel that it's obvious that this was a murder. Some of the responses have been that it was very clear based on what happened between Ahmaud Arbery and Travis, where Travis McMichael, where Ahmaud ran for the gun, that Travis McMichael fired at him in self-defense. And one juror that said something that really spoke to me was that an equally important factor in all this to her was why the video was taken in the first place. She actually went as far as to call it vicious and disgusting that Roddy Bryan filmed the video, because by what she believes the purpose of him filming that video was not for us to be able to see what happened, but that she's glad that it exists because that is what it's allowing for us to know what happened and for there to be some sort of evidence of the exchange that happened in Satilla Shores. So it's already influencing. It's not entirely clear what the prosecution wants to do with it, but what has been more and more evident is that the moments, the final moments of Ahmaud Arbery's life, that is something that was captured on video, and that is something that the prosecution wants people to see, wants them to see that Ahmaud Arbery was in a situation that he felt that he couldn't get out of.
Mm-hmm. And Major, how do you think the kind of proliferation of video, how is that changing activism when it comes to racial justice issues? Does it make it, of course, Arbery is not the only young Black man who's gotten killed at the hands of white people who don't believe they should be in a place, but how does that change activism? Does it make it easier as kind of an organizer yourself to kind of bring the public on board?
Again, I might be unpopular in my position on this question, but it doesn't. What it does is the people who have to speak to these families, right? When the video was released to the public, the family of Ahmaud Arbery hadn't seen it, not once. I remember getting a call saying the family's freaking out because they had been calling for transparency in the investigation for months. It adds to the trauma of seeing Black bodies. I don't even call them Black people because literally their bodies, their corpses, is draining in the streets. And there was an investigation done by Court TV, and it showed the actual body of Ahmaud Arbery laying in the street where officers of the law, as well as EMS officials, were literally standing over his body. Just standing. And he was still breathing. And to see that over and over and over again, It really highlights the urgency of the work that is being done right now, because truth be told, yeah, it may help us get more justice. But the reality is that is a human being who's laying right there. And for so many of us who are consuming this kind of feed over and over again, at some point, it literally will cause a crisis of consciousness that requires us to go to therapy and go through all kinds of intense healing practices, because the reality, again, is that is a human being right there. And we've desensitized it so much that it requires of us to see a dead corpse lying in the street, blood draining our gutters, in our sewers to be able to say, well, there he goes. Now we have to do something because there's no way this could happen here. This is not who we are. This is not what we do. But yes, it is. We've seen the historic legacy of systemic racism play out in the streets. It was in the streets and on the corners of cities and towns where black bodies were literally hanging from poplar trees. Strange fruit, as the song goes. So I would caution us whether it's important for us to celebrate the proliferation of seeing black bodies literally hang in the balance. That is not justice. It is not right. It is not necessary. And it will continue to add to the entire racial terror that we're continuing to fight against.
Fred, how do these videos change the way that the legal system deals with cases like this?
Well, I mean, it's obviously furnished evidence on one hand. On the other hand, it's creating difficulties in finding an impartial jury today. When it comes to more broadly, though, right, beyond, I mean, I think that clearly having a video will make it, the prosecution's burden here is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, right, prove the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Video evidence will unquestionably help that. But there's kind of two layers to the question, right? One is, how is it going to play out in this trial? But then there's the broader question about how is this playing out in the mind of the public? And I'll say, I mean, bodies, burial sites, and photographs of dead bodies have a particular place in our culture. And sort of at this just very like visceral human level, right? I mean, when you're in a graveyard, right? As a kid, you know, and your parent says, don't step on that, right? Laws against desecrating a site. And when it comes to photographs, historically there have been photographs that have been used to terrorize, right? Photographs of hanging bodies. There have been people who sometimes have been charged with abuse of corpse, like soldiers who've taken pictures of individuals after they've killed them. And then there's also been moments throughout American history that we've celebrated the release of photographs, like the mother of Emmett Till. And that was kind of this, it had a very different resonance. So photographs in particular have this very different place where sometimes the release of them is kind of celebrated as a moment that is exposing unimaginable brutality and brutishness and exposing in a very raw way the system. And other times it's a moment not to celebrate at all. And so I think in these moments, in some ways, when photographs are released, it's important to think about, well, what distinguishes one from the other? One thing that distinguishes one from the other is that in the Emmett Till case, it was the mother, it was a family member who chose to do that, right? As opposed to here, where the mother didn't know about it at all, right? So that's one distinction. And then the other is just in terms of its necessity. And it's, it does seem like maybe it was necessary for this video to be released for this criminal accountability to ultimately happen, but that should not have been so, because the people who had it were in a position to make this decision without traumatizing the rest of us.
We're going to have to take our final break in a minute, but before we do, I want to send one more question Major's way. I think I know the answer, but I'm curious to hear what you have to say. Fred brought up Emmett Till and his mother releasing this photograph of him, and it did become a turning point in kind of the national consciousness when it came to race. And I've heard activists talk about how maybe this Arbery case can be kind of an Emmett Till moment for the country. I'm curious if you agree with that statement.
I don't. And reason why is because Emmett Till's murderers were not held accountable to generations later. I think if I recall correctly, it was posthumously after they passed away. And the lady who cried, or the woman rather, who cried and said that he had raped her, she wasn't held accountable either. Even after these photos were released. There was no accountability, right? The system did not work. And we're still fighting these failures, these deficiencies, these hang-ups generations later. This is 400 years, and we're still having the same conversations of whether or not we are making progress. I mean, the people, I mean, you see the guy who's right behind me, John Lewis, he got beat on Selma's Bridge, and we're still fighting the right to vote, right? In October of 2021, we're still fighting for the right to vote. And so though we make these very important strides in history and we celebrate them as progress, it seems as though the American pattern is we take 3, 4, 5 steps back every time we take one step forward. And if that is the human condition, if that is the pattern of human existence, then we have a long way to go.
All right. We have to get to our final break. Stick around and we'll be right back with more Political Rewind. We're back with more Political Rewind. I'm Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter at the AJC, standing in for Bill Nygut. Our panel today is Major Woodall from the Southern Center for Human Rights, Fred Smith of Emory University, and my AJC colleague, Asia Simone Burns. I'd like to spend the last 10 or so minutes of the show talking about policy a little bit. Asia, one of the main defenses that we're hearing from the lawyer for the McMichaels is that they were just exercising, you know, their right under what was the law of the land at the time in Georgia, the citizen's arrest law. Of course, that's since been overhauled by the state legislature. But talk a little bit about how they're using this defense and kind of their strategy here.
Well, essentially what they're saying about the citizen's arrest law that was existing at the time of this incident that resulted in Ahmaud Arbery's death is that they had prior knowledge that there were break-ins going on in the Satola Shores neighborhood. They believed that Ahmaud Arbery was the person who was committing these break-ins, that because they suspected that he had been committing a felony and that he was in the neighborhood that day to commit a felony, they wanted to pursue him, detain him, and talk to him and figure out, hey, what are you doing here? Are you doing these break-ins, and detain him until police arrive? The prosecution in this case has really been, she's pushed back against that a lot. Linda Donikofsky has, in saying that in order to justify a citizen's arrest, there has to be a felony that was committed. And in this case, there's no evidence that Ahmaud Arbery took anything from the home that he was in the Satola Shores neighborhood. There's no evidence that he had been a part of the break-ins, and there's no evidence at all that he had actually been committing a felony. And so to say that they were committing a citizen's arrest that day, that's what they were trying to do, there's nothing to back that up.
Fred, of course, since Arbery's death, the state, you know, state legislators have gone in and overhauled the citizen's arrest statute. How straightforward is the law when it comes to looking at criminal activity and kind of what used to be the law, but what has since changed?
Yeah, so under the United States Constitution, ex post facto laws are unconstitutional. So you can't hold someone criminally liable for something that wasn't criminally liable at the time of the conduct, right? So if today we have this show and tomorrow the state legislature passed a law that said nobody can be on Political Rewind anymore, we would obviously sue, but in the interim, we wouldn't be able to be held accountable for something that wasn't illegal at the time that we did it, right? And so so these particular defendants are going to get the benefit of this law, even though this law has subsequently been eradicated. And, you know, I'll just say on a personal note, thank goodness it has. I mean, the idea, like as you were recounting this, in my own mind, I was thinking, why couldn't Ahmaud then detain them? Because they were in the middle of the illegal activity of detaining him. I mean, it's, and the idea that that they thought that that was their role and they thought that that was their place does kind of really touch into this historical vein that goes back into centuries in terms of it's very racialized, this idea that, that they were in a position to detain this other person because they suspected, they not being law enforcement, suspected that they were breaking the law.
Major, I want to talk about what you think is possible politically in the state legislature in terms of change as a result of what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. Of course, since his death, the legislature passed a hate crime statute. They overhauled the citizens' arrest law. Do you think anything else is politically possible at this point?
Most definitely. I think, you know, when we look at, and again, I say this not as someone who's an attorney, because I am not, but as someone who is a policy professional, is that what's at the center of this case is not citizens' arrest, because we see that the statutory obligations that were invoked were not met, right? And so that isn't necessarily part of this case. If a defense attorney wants to lift up self-defense or stands the ground in the use of excessive force and deadly force in the use of self-defense that follows the stands the ground doctrines of self-defense, then maybe you'll see that come out. It's also showing up in many ways throughout the state, because we have pending cases like the one that's in Statesboro, Bullitt County right now, that's talking through this self-defense claim of, you know, do you have a duty to retreat? I believe that that's going to be something that we see moving forward. When the stands of ground doctrine when the council doctrine was expanded to include stands of ground, because stands of ground is a separate part of the council doctrine. It's not something that is inherently included within that doctrine. What we found was that Georgia and states like Georgia, Florida, and et cetera, they wanted to ensure that folks could be equally aggressive, they could equally use force, whether deadly or otherwise, that would really neutralize any threat. And so when you have cases in which people are the primary aggressors, there's case law that suggests that there are certain things you must do. And so I think the General Assembly will take that up, or if they do not, it would behoove them to, because you're having cases now where folks are engaged in private interactions between citizens and even law enforcement now, right? There's a case in Washington County, Yearly Martin's death, that's lifting up how that interaction between the public and private exists, but primarily around these private citizens engaging in uses of force that ends up in one person dying and the other person literally claiming self-defense. So I foresee that being something that it comes out of not only the Mod case, but the Marcus Wilson case in Statesboro, the Yearly Martin case in Washington County, and so many others.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see the legislature truly changing the way that it approaches gun rights and that sort of thing. This would just be tinkering with what stand your ground means?
Well, I don't think this is a... You know, some people will talk about the gun rights and those kind of things, and that's important. And I think that there's a time and a place for that. But I think as it relates to these issues, it really just exceeds just black versus white, right? It really talks through, can we live in a state where people can protect and defend themselves without fear that they would now be criminally liable for something that took place that they didn't put themselves in that situation, but they had to respond nevertheless. And so I think it is a concern that Republicans and Democrats alike should have, because it impacts all of us, right? It impacts all of us.
Mm-hmm. And Asia, we are not doing jury selection today down in Brunswick. It sounds like one of the lawyers in this case had a personal obligation, but what's on deck for next week, and what are you expecting to play out?
Next week, the jury selection process will continue. The judge has said that they're going to get started again 8:30 on Monday morning. At this point, there have been 23 prospective jurors qualified, and they're trying to get to 64. At the rate that they're going, it could take all of next week. Potentially, it could stretch into the following week. It really depends on if it continues at the pace that it's currently going, or if they pick up the pace a little bit.
And Fred, what are you looking for in the weeks ahead?
Yeah, right. So I'm looking for how are the peremptory challenges, or try to use more legally, how are the various challenges used? Who gets removed? What does the ultimate jury look like? How much does that reflect the general population in Glynn County? whether or not the prosecution says that that there have been discriminatory uses of it. Those are some of the things I'm looking for. And again, I don't expect there to be a change of venue motion as there was, say, 20 years ago when the sheriff of DeKalb County was killed and that murder was tried in Albany. I don't expect anything of that sort, but I guess it's something to be on the lookout for. And I think in every sense, we're going to, across the state and across the nation and to some extent across the world, we're going to all be watching this very closely.
Major, you got about 2 minutes left. What are you looking for in the weeks ahead?
I'm simply looking for humanity. I'm looking for a community of support for our families there in Brunswick, Georgia. I'm looking for the collective society at large to be able to come together and really have honest and open debate about the issues that plague our people in our state to this day. And ultimately, accountability. To be able to say that we live in a place where the kinds of murders, the kinds of vicious acts that happened to Ahmaud on February 28th of 2020 doesn't happen again. And unfortunately, it may, it probably will, it's already had, but we can move the needle a little bit towards that ideal space called justice.
All right, Major gets the last word. That's all the time we have for Political Rewind today. I'd like to thank our guest, Asia Simone Burns, in her first time on the show, Fred Smith from Emory, Major Woodall. Bill Nygut will be back on Monday, and I'd like to take a moment at the end of the show here to congratulate him on being inducted today to the Georgia Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame. Much deserved after such a long and storied career. I want to thank GPB's Sam Burmis-Dawes and Jesse Neiswanger for their work. I'm Tamar Hallerman. Thank you for joining us and have a great rest of your day.